May it please the Court, Suzanne Luban for Willie Randolph, petitioner. I'd like to remind the Court that this case is not governed by the ADPA. And so, in the two issues I would like to address today, publicity, the prejudicial, and the FOIA claim, neither one of those issues are state court findings that this Court needs to give a presumption of correctness to. So this Court is required and invited to make an independent view of the record. As to the pretrial publicity claim, this case presented a particularly sensational, lurid collection of facts which the media capitalized on, and there was a resurgence of media stories following the mistrial. My client's retrial, which is the trial that brought about his conviction, was 2 months later. So there were a series of news articles and news reports in the last bit of time for his trial that exposed the public, and in particular the jury pool, to the fact that his victim was a 10-year-old boy, the method of killing, that he was shot in the head, the bizarre role of the father, these were the allegations that the father had hired the defendant to kill his son for financial gain, to avoid paying $60 a month in child support. And the newspaper article featured the adorable photo of the victim and the not-so-adorable photo of my client, as well as the, and this is an additional factor, all the factors actually, the second factor I want to address is the style of reporting, the sensational style used the term hitman, murder for hire, the execution style slang, a term that came directly in a quote from the district attorney. The district attorney also gave press the story about how the victim had extended his hand in an attempt to ward off the bullet, and the bullet went through his hand. But even more significantly, the press reported inadmissible facts, which the jury should never have known, that my client had a serious prior record. The press reported his gang rape conviction, the fact that he was in San Quentin in prison during the time that he was arrested on this case, that he had prior residential robbery conviction, and that there was a hung jury in this case, which implied that in his previous trial, which implied that there were some jurors who thought he should be found guilty, and that the DA sought the death penalty in that case, in the first trial. So one-third of the jury veneer and one-third of the sitting jury admitted to being exposed to this type of media exposure. And although the jurors said that it didn't affect them, that they didn't form opinions, and that some people said they didn't follow it up, they were able to spout details of the case, and several of the jurors said that the facts were very disturbing to them. And one juror said he couldn't help but think of all the things that he had read in sitting as a juror, and that it makes this case appropriate to follow on the heels of the previous case, a case in which jurors might not be expected to follow instructions. So just as in Bruton cases and in cases where in trial the defendant's prior record comes in, there are some things that the jury cannot be expected to ignore. In this case, it was the press accounts that these jurors read. It's also important to note that there was minimal evidence of my client's guilt showing the impact of the press report. Really, the only evidence against my client was that a person who 5 years later came forward and told police that he had seen my client standing near the open trunk of his car parked near the roadside where the boy's body was found, and that this individual had a lifelong grudge against my client. And then the jailhouse informants who, even without their recantation, they were severely impeached at trial. And the mother's inconsistent statements about threats that were made, but she identified the father as the person in a car that she saw. Now, my client had 59 IQ, so when he was confronted by police, he denied ever having been to Riverdale, and he denied that that was his car. That was basically the substance of the government's case against my client. So I urge the court to find that there was presumed prejudice in this case as a result of this publicity. I can move on to the Messiah claim.
Was there a look for change of venue prior to the second trial?
There was not, Your Honor.
What significance does that have in this situation?
Well, none, because there was no procedural default noted by the California Supreme Court. This issue was raised by my client in a California Supreme Court petition, and he alleged that all of the publicity up until the time of his second trial was prejudicial.
Only in the California Supreme Court petition, not elsewhere?
I'm sorry?
Was it raised before the California Court of Appeals?
No, it was not raised on, it was raised in a habeas petition indicating evidence outside the record. Actually, I don't believe that it was raised for the California Supreme Court in the, for the CA. But so there was no procedural default, and in fact, the district court did reluctantly consider the evidence of the later articles. And there's evidence in the record of what these jurors said that they saw in the news, but they were not given an opportunity really to testify about their feelings. They were given, cross-examination questions. Do you feel that you can be fair? You can put this all aside, follow the court's instructions, that kind of questioning, which any reasonable juror is going to know what the appropriate answer to. And they gave those answers. They said they could be fair, although they were disturbed. Any further questions on that issue? Moving on to the Messiah claim, this is regarding Ronnie Moore, the individual who was placed for 2 months in the cell with my client. The critical question here is the definition of listening post when used in the context left open by Henry, by the U.S. Supreme Court in Henry, regarding whether a person can be, in fact, a passive listening post. And certainly, the U.S. Supreme Court found in Pullman that a person can be that if they do not take any action at all to elicit or encourage conversation with the defendant. And that would truly be somebody who's maybe placed in another cell and has no interaction with the defendant. But in this case, all the Henry factors are present. Mr. Moore had an incentive to elicit information from Mr. Randolph. He knew he was seeking leniency. He said in his deposition, when I asked him, what did you think you were going to get out of this? What did you think if you provided information to the state? And he said, well, everyone knows, and everyone does know, that snitches receive leniency. And in fact, he certainly did receive leniency. He was released on his own recognizance pending trial, so he certainly knew that more was coming. He also, Mr. Randolph didn't know, of course, that Moore was working for the police, and they had that intimate connection of sharing a two-man cell. They also had additional factors that increased my client's vulnerability, which are things that the Henry Court considered. My client's 59 IQ and his vulnerability, Mr. Moore described that other defendants took, other cellmates took advantage of him or stole money and cigarettes from him. My client was undoubtedly known to be slow-witted. And he also shared this common plight of two black men in jail facing what they believed to be unfair charges. Mr. Moore was definitely not a passive listening device. He subtly admitted, and the district court accepted his admission, that he subtly encouraged and facilitated conversation. He said my client was easy to get to talk about different things, and that he would ask questions about my client when he came about the court proceedings when my client came back in. If my client brought up the topic, then he would allow my client to go on. That consists of encouraging and eliciting statements.
All right, so the district court's finding here are fact sort of peculiar because he first admits, agrees that these things happen and then says, oh, but the gravamen was otherwise. But one never, as I understand the district court's opinion, which I guess was a magistrate judge opinion later affirmed, later adopted, he never really resolved the question of whether there was one, two, or three meetings and whether whether Moore may have given them some of this information before they ever asked him to do anything. Now, A, does that matter? And B, if it does, what do we do? If we agreed with your argument you're now making, what would we do at that point?
Well, it's true. The district court said it was confusing and it felt that there was some evidence that perhaps admissions had been made before, but said it was resolving the issue on the decision that Mr. Moore was a passive listening device.
Right.
That's
what I'm asking you. If we accepted your view of that matter, what would we do on the other issue? Does the other issue matter, and what would we do on it?
Well, this court is required to make an independent review of the record, and I have noted in my brief.
You would make a fact finding about the order in which, about whether there were one, two, or three meetings? And
yes. Especially because the district court did not make a finding.
We wouldn't remand to the district court?
De novo. It's a de novo review.
Why is it de novo?
Because this is a habeas case, and the district court's decision is, the court didn't make a factual finding.
Well, I understand it didn't make a factual finding on that. It made factual findings on other things. But if it didn't make a factual finding, we make it instead of sending it back to him to make it.
I think so, Your Honor. I mean, that is my feeling about it. If we go back to remand and we certainly present the evidence all over again. But I want to point out to you that all the evidence was before the district court. I want to give you just a couple of ER sites to look at specifically, ER 187 and ER 198, which are pretrial interviews Mr. Moore gave. One of them is a taped interview with Detective Pete Chavez, one of the people who is doing the cultivating of Mr. Moore's cooperation. And he talks about how my client discussed the details of his trial after his mistrial. Specifically says, and then he says the same thing in his 99 deposition at 156, and the evidentiary hearing at SER 1-37.
But that's not inconsistent. My understanding is that the government agents claim that they met with him about a week after the mistrial, but not before that.
The agents claim that, well, right, they don't say what time the mistrial occurred, but we know the mistrial occurred on August 15th. And there's a report by Pete Chavez on August 24th. So what they deny is that there was a meeting on August 17th, the day Mr. Moore came to court and brought his letter. Well, Mr. Moore talks about having written his letter with Mr. Randolph's help during the time that they shared this relationship of trust. Mr. Randolph was giving him his advice that he should go to the DA and he'd use him as an example and say he doesn't want to end up like his cellmate who started out doing these little crimes and then now look at him, he's in prison facing murder charges. And this is all at a time when Mr. Moore still believes that my client is innocent. Well, he couldn't have made these admissions prior to the time that Mr. Moore wrote that letter if he's sharing this relationship of trust with him. And then he's taken out to a different cell for fighting. He's been fighting with people in the cell block. So he's removed to a different jail, actually, for at least a week, but probably longer, during the time period that then my client's first trial ends in a mistrial. He didn't know about the mistrial. When he came to court on the 17th, he had this letter from his previous time with Mr. Randolph. But he's not been in the cell with him for a few days. He comes to court, gives the letter to his lawyer, and that day he testified and extensively testified that he met with the DA and his. But why then would he be sent back into the same cell? He was evicted, basically, from that jail cell block for fighting. But he's put back in there. It makes sense. At the direction of the DA and the detective.
But at a minimum, there was conflicting evidence on this, right? I mean, the government, Chavez and the other person said one thing and he said another, and somebody needs to resolve a conflict. And I'm having a hard time understanding why it's not.
Well, we invited the district court to do that.
Right.
The court failed to do it.
But he decided on an alternative ground. If we disagreed with his alternative ground, doesn't he have to make the fact?
Well, then I suppose if the court feels that a remand is appropriate, then that would be the action to take. There were actually three different stories given because Chavez talked about all the characteristics of one of the meetings that Mr. Moore talked about. I forget which, being in a jury room or a courtroom, one person leading the meeting, a different person leading the other meeting. Mr. Chavez doesn't mention in his report about the extensive statement, conversation that Moore has with the district attorney about what are his motives and what does he think he's going to get out of this. This sort of a challenging confrontation that goes on. But Mr. Oppelger, the DA, talks about that. Well, he's describing the first meeting, and Mr. Chavez is describing the second meeting, the meeting he recorded. Mr. Chavez testified that he doesn't record introductory meetings with informants, and in fact, he didn't write a report about his introductory meeting with Mr. Conkle, the other jailhouse informant. So it's consistent that when there's not being detailed evidence or confessions related, that Mr. Chavez doesn't write a report about it. And in this case, he didn't. But Mr. Moore testified about that introductory meeting, and from that moment forward, he knew that he was on the government's, not payroll, but on the leniency roll, and had an incentive to seek and elicit information from Mr. Randolph. Then it follows when he says that after the mistrial, Mr. Randolph, he talked about this long before we knew about the Messiah plan. He talked about this in 1989, or 1988, one of these 89, I guess, tape interviews, that he, my client started to say things about his case, and Mr. Moore perked up his ears and became interested. Well, there's a reason he became interested. He was busy trying to spy on my client, to use his words, and elicit information. Now, I want to point out, too, that although the police may say to an informant, don't directly ask any questions, don't be specific, be his friend, just let him talk to you. That does not include the finding of a Messiah violation. And in this case, it's certainly likely that Mr. Officer gave that what he called his listening post speech to Mr. Moore. But the fact that Mr. Moore went ahead and was friendly and elicited information from my client by engaging in friendly conversation, that was the functional equivalent of interrogation. You know, I'm down to my last 4 minutes and 30 seconds, but I want to point out that this Messiah claim and all the arguments that I've made around it also relates directly to two other claims in the petition, the due process claim for the unreliability of Mr. Moore and also Mr. Conkle, and I don't withdraw those claims by not raising them, there's just not enough time. And the Brady claim that was only disclosed to me when I was able to interview Mr. Moore that this had all happened. It was not disclosed to the defense. I'll reserve the remainder.
Thank you. We'll now hear from the state.
My name is Janice Shank McLean. I'm the Deputy Attorney General with the State Attorney General's Office. It is difficult to even fathom a case that has received more, that would receive more scrutiny than this case has received. We have had there's an evidentiary hearing from the trial court on a number of matters. There was a 3-day evidentiary hearing involving both of the informants, both and the prosecution team, judge, the prosecutor being Mr. Offenberg, now sitting on the Fresno Superior Court. There has been. This is an entirely fact-based claim. What you just heard from counsel is her version of the facts. I, of course, have mine based on the evidence that I believe. But the magistrate judge sat there for 3 days and listened to these.
But he didn't resolve one of the major questions. He just didn't.
He did.
No,
and
he
I'll
didn't. He
look at the findings and recommendations, which is at excerpt of record, page 751. He did not decide this on the alternative ground. He decided it in fact. He bulletproofed it by deciding it in a number of different ways. At page 751 at the bottom.
Yeah, but that's your problem. That's not your solution. That's why he says it's not clear.
No, he doesn't. That's not what he's saying. He's saying there is substantial evidence in the record to support a finding.
Substantial evidence in the record. There's also, not a finding.
He decides that Messiah claim on three different grounds, finds three different problems with it. One, he says, although it's not clear, because there's a great dispute about these dates of these August 17th, August 24th.
These are the statements that there's substantial evidence in the record to support a finding that petitioner's admission was made to Moore. Is a finding that petitioner's admission was made to Moore?
I'm sorry.
That he's resolved the evidentiary dispute. All he's done is say that there is an evidentiary dispute.
He goes on. He makes several findings. At the bottom of this page, he says there's substantial evidence to support a determination that the petitioner's admissions were made to Brown between Randolph and Moore before the prosecutor was ever involved. He then flips over to on 752. He says, even if there is some possibility that those admissions were made before, I find no evidence that there was any instructions with regard to deliberative.
Yeah, and of course that's wrong. There is evidence. He chooses not to believe it, but we've got testimony.
His job is to weigh the evidence.
No, I'm saying what's wrong is he says there is no evidence. Well, there is evidence. Moore specifically testifies that he was told not to ask obvious questions, but that the questions were all right. I mean, the fact finder, the magistrate, might have chosen not to believe that evidence, but the statement that there is no evidence is flatly untrue.
I believe he goes on, I can't recall any details here, but he sat there and listened to everybody's credibility. He had the informants in front of him. He had reams of documentary evidence detailing the various, the investigation that occurred in the case, He had all the meetings that were the prosecution team had and documented certain documents. He had the live testimony in front of him. We had done depositions in this case. He had all of this information in front of him. He had the trial testimony. He had the hearings that had occurred on the reliability of
on Judge Fletcher's question. He says there's no evidence to support a finding that Moore was either instructed to to deliberately list all that more in fact elicited incriminating statements. Well, Moore testifies, did you prompt Mr. Randolph to give you more details when you bring up a topic? I figured if he wasn't suspicious in me asking about it, then I asked him about it. Later on, he gives an example of one instance in which he asked him, he said, give me an example of where you did that. And he says, well, I asked him, who was that guy who said he saw you or something like that. And he gives examples. He says, you know, five or six different times that he did ask him questions, as long as specific questions, as long as they weren't obvious. And then the magistrate judge essentially still recognized, because in his file finding, as he says, Moore did respond in the affirmative to an inquiry whether he said anything to petitioner to elicit or encourage information to him, and to an inquiry whether he led him on. But the gravamen of Moore's testimony was that petitioner wants to talk, it was easy to get him to talk.
Well, I said that when he says there's no evidence, he's finding out no credible evidence. We litigated this case. We litigated in depositions, and then we had live testimony. The judge heard all the testimony, then he looked at all the documentary evidence, and when he got done, he decided that the evidence did not show that there were instructions on deliberate elicitation, nor had there been action that was credible.
Do you think that he was finding, I mean, this is possible, but he certainly didn't make it explicit. You think he was finding Moore not credible the seven or eight different times when he said that he was asking these questions?
I think after weighing all of the evidence, there certainly were, in some instances, Mr. Moore, now, we're 11 years, when these things occurred, we're 11 years after these events, okay? There were instances in the deposition, there were instances in the, when we have live testimony, where, and don't forget, Mr. Moore in his deposition said that he was afraid of Mr. Randolph. That he was concerned that about how Mr. Randolph would feel about him. So he's testifying and he's giving us depositions, and he would start to stray and he would say something, and then if you questioned him further, he would then make it clear, no, that's not what I mean. I just listened to him. The magistrate did exactly what you asked them to do. He heard all of this. He synthesized all of this information. And when he got done, he found three problems with the Messiah claim. He found that there was substantial evidence that the disclosures had happened before there was ever any contact with the prosecutors. He found that even if there was some possibility that wasn't the case, that there was no instructions deliberately elicit and no action taken. And he also found that as in the U.S. versus Henry situation, there was no promise of a benefit. That he might have had some hopes and dreams and desires, but that wasn't enough under U.S.
Henry. Is an explicit promise necessary? An explicit promise of benefits necessary?
Yes. In U.S. v. Henry, it was a contingency agreement.
No, I'm asking you a different question. Is an explicit promise of benefit necessary, or is an implicit understanding sufficient?
I have found no cases that would support a implicit, any kind of hope and desire.
I'm sorry. You moved to hope and desire. I said implicit understanding.
There wasn't in this case.
No, I'm asking a different question, just as the case law.
I have not found a case that I cannot think of.
Let me read to you. This is on cross. Supplemental excerpts, volume 1, page 147 and 148. Moore has been cross-examined. And did they specifically tell you not to ask questions? They didn't say not to ask questions. It was like, don't ask obvious questions, like that. They said, don't ask obvious questions? Yeah, don't ask questions the way you get suspicious or something like that. You specifically recall that? Something similar to that. And then later on in the same cross, do you remember them specifically telling you not to arouse your suspicions? Yes, I remember that. Okay, and do you recall them specifically telling you not to ask questions? Yes, I remember that too. And they told you to let him volunteer information? Yes. Well, all of those things may be true. That is to say, they might have said, don't ask obvious questions, don't make him suspicious, and they might also have said, don't ask questions. I mean, I'm very unhappy in a lot of these cases, and including in this one. The listening post speech could easily have been recorded, and we would not be dependent upon this kind of testimony to determine what, in fact, he was told to do. And it was fully in their control as to whether or not to record it. So here we are with the testimony where he says, they tell me not to ask obvious questions. And in multiple places, he says, well, yeah, I wanted to tell me stuff.
The prosecutor also, though, he also is a very credible witness in this proceeding, and he denied that he would have, you know, he obviously had no interest in creating a fire problem here.
But of course he had every interest in getting evidence, but he had no interest in getting a Messiah problem. I understand that. I agree with you.
Yes, but there's a big difference there. He has interest in getting evidence that is beneficial, of course, to the case, but it doesn't help a prosecutor to commit a Messiah violation and reverse the case. We are now, this murder happened in 1981. If this case is reversed, it's now 2004. You know, this is, the trial happened in 89. The prosecutor denied that that occurred. The investigator denied that it occurred. Mr. Moore was all over the board. He was 11 years down the line from when it happened. He admitted he was fearful.
On the question of whether he actually asked questions as opposed to whether they told him to ask questions, he was fairly consistent. He wasn't off the board.
Again, I believe if you look at the totality of evidence, just as the magistrate judge did, and subsequently by the district court judge, you will come to the conclusion that there was no credible evidence, certainly not enough, to establish a Messiah violation. And that wouldn't be the end of the problem here. If all the evidence was presented before, just as the magistrate said there's substantial evidence that the information was passed on before the prosecutor ever got involved, it really wouldn't matter. We would never even get to this point. And
well, that may be, so I wish you'd resolve that question.
Right, and the thing was that Mr. Moore, when he spoke, he said, you know, initially when I was in the cell with him, he really wasn't telling me very much, and then things started, his first trial started to look good. Things were going well for him because there was a mistrial in this case. And then he started to talk. Well, that occurred well before the prosecutors, you know, the prosecutors didn't come on the scene in this context with Mr. Moore, any relationship with Mr. Moore, until well after the trial had already been declared a mistrial. So those communications happened early on. The magistrate judge believed that the information was passed early.
He really didn't say that. I mean, you he really don't do your argument any good by misrepresenting what's said in the
speech.
Which is only that there's substantial evidence in the record to support it, which is not a finding.
He found substantial evidence of that. I think that he was on the front line. He saw these witnesses.
Well, there was substantial evidence to support it. There was substantial evidence to support the contrary as well, and he had a result, and he didn't.
He did. He resolved it. I'm sorry, I disagree. I think that he found it occurred based on the circumstances that the disclosures happened earlier. Furthermore, though, he found that it didn't matter because the deliberate elicitation never occurred.
Further, he finds it doesn't matter because there's, quote, no evidence to support a finding that he was either instructed to deliberately elicit incrimination or that he in fact took action to don't do so.
Another basis for
what I'm saying to you is that's wrong. That's flatly wrong. He says there is no evidence, and then he's goes to two things, that Moore was either instructed to deliberately elicit incriminating statements. There is some evidence, which perhaps is not credible given that he says several different things. And he also says there is no evidence that Moore, in fact, took action to do so. Moore consistently testifies, I asked him questions.
And he says what questions he asked?
When this court looked at all of the evidence that the magistrate judge looked at, that you will not be able to say that you cannot say that his conclusion was clearly erroneous.
He also said at the end, he said, Moore specifically denied prompting petitioner to give him any more details, and petitioner did start talking. All right. And here's the site. Did you prompt Mr. Randolph to give you more details when you bring up the topic? No, I'm not going to say I did that. So that's what he was relying on. And then, I mean, if he was willing to tell me if he would be on the subject, then I would probably ask him a question about that. But I wasn't. I would just say, hey, what about the father? Did he do this? It was whatever he volunteered. It was along the line of that, and I figured he wasn't suspicious in me asking him about it. Then I asked him about it. So in the very paragraph on which the magistrate judge is relying, he says exactly the opposite.
I believe when this court looks at the totality of evidence that the magistrate looked at, that you cannot say that this is a clearly erroneous ruling. that the magistrate was on the front line. He saw all of the evidence. He saw the people involved here, and then he reached these conclusions. He also found that there was, that hopes and desires aren't enough, which is a third problem with the Messiah violation. So, and with regard to, let me move on just briefly to the publicity argument. I think that there's an admission there was no actual prejudice in this case. There was presumption of prejudice claim that was made. However, the trial counsel, presumably, counsel tries to wave it away and say, well, geez, just because he didn't bring a second change of venue, that didn't really matter. But the fact of the matter is, it's a good indication of the fact that he's happy with the situation. He's satisfied. He had only, they were very concerned, of course, about the publicity in this case. The judge, they had extensive discussions. They put together a questionnaire that specifically asked about their exposure. If they found anybody that had been exposed, they took them into a private unit away from the rest of the jurors. They individually questioned them. Ultimately, they had four jurors who admitted some exposure to the publicity, two of the alternates. This is not a type of a situation that involves the saturation of prejudice. The magistrate appropriately found that. The trial court appropriately found that. The state court of appeal appropriately found that. And I would ask this court to also reach that conclusion. Any other questions?
Thank you very much for your argument.
The magistrate did not reject Ronnie Moore's credibility. Instead of his findings and recommendations, he accepted as true Mr. Moore's statements that he led on my client, that he encouraged him, and that he was friendly and talkative. On the page that you were reading?
I remember saying
I believe it's ER 752. Said he responded affirmatively to an inquiry whether he said anything to the petitioner to elicit and encourage. And then moving on to an inquiry whether he led him on to provide more with information. And then he holds that the gravamen of his testimony, which I think essentially means what the judge thought was the most important part of his testimony, but certainly wasn't the only part of his testimony, was that
We may infer from this that the magistrate accepted these statements are true, but the magistrate does not say that.
He doesn't say that he doesn't.
Of course.
I think the finding here by the court is that that isn't enough. It's a legal decision. It's a legal ruling on what is active versus passive listening. And I disagree with it, and I urge the court to disagree with it. It is not passive listening post behavior to be talkative and friendly with an individual and to try to comfort him and encourage him to talk about his case. It is passive listening to be standing in the next room, noting what you hear. Also, I want to address something that I believe is a misstatement. The prosecutor said that my client was talking about his case near the end of the case when his trial was looking good. It is unclear when Mr. Moore was testifying at trial exactly what specific time period he was talking about, but later when he talked about, in the same tone, what was the sea change that occurred in my client's demeanor, changed his view about my client's guilt, was that he was talking about him bragging that the DA couldn't try him again, that it would be too expensive to try him again. And that, of course, happened after the mistrial. And so that is consistent with the other statements about him having come back into the cell after the mistrial, equipped with his incentive to elicit information from my client. And my client is now thrilled that he's gotten a mistrial and is talking about it and begins to talk about his case. Well, Mr. Moore suddenly is very interested in his case. So that leads me directly to the issue of whether an explicit promise, an explicit contract is necessary. And I agree with Judge Fletcher that certainly there was an implicit contract in this case. There was a contract with Mr. Consul, and that is illustrative because in that contract says basically that the DA will write a letter and he'll say something that's very unspecific. If Mr. Consul provides his testimony. Doesn't say he'll give him a break, doesn't say he'll recommend a lower sentence, but clearly that's the point of that kind of a letter. No prosecutor wants to write in there exactly what they're going to recommend because it doesn't look good before the jury. It diminishes the informant's credibility. In this case, they took it one step further, didn't give him a contract at that point, they just sent him in. It was known to Mr. Moore why he was being moved back to the cell with Mr. Randolph. There could be no other reason other than he was supposed to provide information. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank both of you for a vigorous and helpful argument. The case of Randolph versus People of the State of California is now submitted for decision.
We are now adjourning for the day to reconvene tomorrow morning. Thank all of you for your attendance, both counsel and students. Oh, I should say the following. It's now 12:45. We've got a lunch. Questions, answer questions. Why don't we do it right now?
Yeah.
If the lawyers would like to clear out, we've got a private session planned with the students so that we can answer a few questions not specific to your cases.
But we're not allowed.
But, well, no, you're not allowed.
We might boo and hiss at our answers.
Yeah, this is judge-student privilege material.
Heard all about that person.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.